Thank you, CC, for the invitation and introduction. And it's my great pleasure to be here at PEI for the first time. And it's like a very fancy building and fancy people here. So today I'm happy to tell you something that I've been working on, which can be concisely formulated as this question. Feel free to stop me and ask questions during the talk. And first, let me give you some broad motivation, like what kinds of problems that we are interested in. So I think I don't need to elaborate too much that there are good reasons to build quantum processors. And for example, people have been making process in like various platforms like superconductors, neutral atoms, trapped ions, optical cavities, and others. And for example, we have demonstrated some kind of quantum information processing tasks in nowadays platforms. And when we talk about quantum information processing, usually one would think about like gate-based models, right? And it is indeed a very important question in like these platforms to understand how to realize like two qubit gates in some like reliable and fast way. However, here comes the observation that processing information just using two qubit gates actually does not fully exploit the full power of these platforms, because many of these platforms actually have what I call large Hamiltonian connectivity, where a qubit can couple to many other qubits at the same time. So that is certainly not captured by gate-based models. For example, for like Rydberg atoms and trapped ions, they have these parallel interactions. Well, for optical cavities, you can even have all-to-all interactions. So then here's like the central question that we want to understand. So it's like, given Hamiltonian collectivity, like parallel or all-to-all, how fast can I realize certain quantum information processing tasks? For example, can it be asymptotically faster than gate-based models? And what's the dependence on the different processing tasks that you are talking about? Okay, and this is sometimes referred to the quantum speed limit problem. And if you are more familiar with like geometric local Hamiltonians in finite dimensions, like what is the case for superconducting processors, then the answer to this question actually turns out to be not that interesting. And there, because your H is still like couple one qubit to several other qubits to a finite number of other qubits, the result of that is that even if you use Hamiltonian evolution, you still have this effective light cone structure, just as in geometric local circuits. And based on that, people have shown that, for example, a geometric local Hamiltonian evolution can be simulated by a quantum circuit with like comparing space volume, space-time volume. So what this question is really interesting, it's really about these like large Hamiltonian connectivity cases like parallel or auto interactions, where this problem is still like there are still many open problems in this area. And so in this talk, I will not talk about noise, et cetera, but this question can also be relevant for like realizing information processing in like recent noisy platforms, because if you can do something faster, then potentially you can also accumulate less error during the process. Okay, so after all, why do we expect that there can be any like Hamiltonian advantage compared to circuits? Well, let me first give you several examples to show that there is indeed advantage. So let me consider the extreme case where, which is like the auto-all Hamiltonian, where each qubit can couple to every other qubit. And I assume like each coupling between a pair of qubits is captured by these coefficients that are bounded by one. So it's like order one coupling per pair. And this xi alpha, where alpha runs from 0, 1, 2, 3, are the Paulis on set I. So I want to compare the Hamiltonian evolution with the gate-based models where I can apply circuits where each layer of the circuit I can apply any two qubit gates, but just demanding that one qubit can only be involved in one gate at each layer. Okay, so let's consider the specific task of preparing an entangled state from a product state, and we ask what's the minimal time or minimal depth for a Hamiltonian evolution or a circuit to realize this target state. Okay, so first, if the target state psi is the JG state, which is all zero plus all one, then there's already some very simple separation to see that for gate-based circuits, it requires at least log n depth. Well, for Hamiltonian, you can prepare GC state exactly in order one time. So why is that? So note that here I use this like big O notations. For example, I say T is O1, means that there exists an order one time protocol. And I say, for example, T is omega log n, means that any protocol that achieves this task requires log n time. And theta is both O and omega. Okay, so let me unpack these results. First, why does gate need at least log n depth? Well, it just uses this kind of Lyapunov argument because you, in the final state, you want to correlate any pair of qubits. But if you just do this gate, then at each layer, you kind of can only at most double the size of the correlation regime that is correlated to a given qubit. So if you want to correlate n qubits, then you use the log n depth. On the other hand, for Hamiltonian, you can just like take one qubit, you view it at a center, and you couple it to all the other leaf qubits where each coupling is like the Hamiltonian that generates the C0 gate. Right, and that will, and you start from like plus in the center or zero on the leaves, and that gives you a GC state in order one time. Okay, so then you might say, well, that is just coming from a kind of artifact that in your gate-based model, maybe you can also assume that commuting gates can be applied at the same time. So then this separation goes away, right? For that, I will say that actually there are good reasons to believe that like GHZ states can be prepared actually in a much shorter time scale. And for example, it is proposed in this paper that if you relax, that you don't need to prepare the exact GHZ state, but you are satisfied as long as you prepare something that is like very positively polarized state superposed with a very negative polarized state. Then you can prepare this GHC-like states in very short time, which is like log n over n. So this is clear some separation, a big separation comparing to gates. And if you actually want to prepare the double state instead of the GHC state, then this separation actually becomes ambiguous. It's like on the one hand, for gate, you still need log n depth. On the other hand, there is an exact protocol that prepares W for 1 over square root of n. So this may be the quickest example for, and simplest example for Hamiltonian advantage. Okay, so since this 1 over square root of n protocol is both simple and it will play a role in the rest of my talk, let me describe it here. So I still have this like one center qubit and n leaf qubit structure. And I want to start, say, from the one state at the center and all zero state on the leaves. And I want to unitary evolve it to zero on the center times all W state on the leaves. Okay, so how can I do this? Well, you kind of just want to coherently move the one excitation from the center to the leaves, right? And then you can actually achieve it simply by like defining this x plus x minus this way, and then you turn on the x plus x minus coupling between each center and between the center and each leaf. So this is kind of like engineers a quantum walk in the one excitation subspace, and in one over square root of n time, you can hop the excitation all to the leaves, or you can just verify it by acting h on the states and verify that it is actually a poly x, square root of n times the poly x in the 2D subspace. So 1 over square root of n time is enough. And if you just slightly modify the time, you can just prepare like a double state on the leaf plus the center qubits. Okay, so this is very nice. But observe that actually to achieve this advantage, you still only use a tiny amount of the outer wall couplings, right? You even don't need to turn on the outer wall couplings between the leaves. And it turns out that it is still an open question to understand what's the ultimate limit. What's the shortest time protocol to achieve a W state, to produce a W state? Or like what's the so-called Hamiltonian lower bound? So this is like kind of one of the many other open questions in this like quantum speed limit. Problems that we are interested in. And so I have demonstrated to you that indeed it's interesting to talking about preparing states what about preparing a certain unitary? And that will be, is there a question? I see. So I think it's like for gates, if you assume like this, like one C gate and two C gate cannot overlap, then essentially you cannot apply the gates at the same time. Okay. And here, I don't think there is any reason to think they can overlap because these couplings do not commute with each other. Because you have X plus and X minus on C, and that makes the difference.
So you're assuming only like two cubic gates in your gate-based model?
Yes.
You don't have like larger cubic
entanglement
gates?
Sure. Okay. So in this talk, I would like to focus on realizing a particular kind of unitary, which is like I want to permute the qubits or like permute more precisely permute the quantum states on the qubits. So why do you want to do that? Well, suppose you are doing like distributed quantum computation, you have like information computed all over the place, and sometimes you want to route them all together to continue your computation. So in some cases, you may have the ability to just move the physical carriers, like the atoms, that contain the qubits. So then in that case, maybe you just want to do that, and that becomes like a classical problem that you want to kind of minimize the paths of these qubits. And that is not what we are interested in here. So here we're saying that in some cases you don't want to do this, like physical routing the qubits, then you want to just acting, say, gates or Hamiltonians on the quantum states itself to permute them. Then kind of what's the ultimate limit that you can do this. Okay, and so then we ask like whether how fast you can do this using Hamiltonian evolution or using gate-based circuits, and perhaps the most conventional way to do this is it starts to decompose your routing to a bunch of swaps, and this is what is called a classical routing in this previous paper. So here we are mainly focused on like these two categories. So we are interested in, first of all, like can Hamiltonian be actually asymptotically faster than gate-based routing? Is there any separation between these two? And furthermore, can we understand what's the ultimate limit of Hamiltonian routing or lower bound? And that's not because like routing can be useful, but also like we want to understand this kind of lower bound problem in general, because previously we have seen that like for state preparation, we don't have much good understanding of that. Okay, so that is the motivation. So here are the outline or main results. My talk is based on these two works where I flip the order so that actually the first one is an ongoing work. The second one is has appeared in archive. The second one is in collaboration with my advisor, Andy. And my postdoc David at CU Boulder. And the first one is in collaboration with Andy and people at Maryland, like Alexei, Andrew Charles, and also current and former graduate students in Alexei's group. Okay, so let me just preview the results here that I will expand in the rest of my talk. So first, we aim to show that there exists some separation between Hamiltonian and gate-based routing. And this is achieved in the first part of my talk, where we find, for the first time, a separation in the so-called star graph. Second, we aim to understand Hamiltonian lower bound, and we develop a kind of method to obtain meaningful Hamiltonian lower bounds. For example, for the star graph case, we prove that the Hamiltonian protocol we use is actually optimal, up to some technicalities. Second, we also use the same method for like the second problem, which is like we ask, what's the shortest time to realize the so-called shift unitary in 1D using parallel interactions? And we say our low bound is also meaningful in this case because of this maybe kind of surprising effect, or which suggests that our bound is like indeed somehow strong, which is that for the power law system, we can also consider what's the minimum time to transmit a signal across the system. And we proved that even at that time scale that you can transmit a signal, that time is still not sufficient for realizing shift. Okay, so that's the second goal I want to achieve. The last one is like just for this shift case, actually there's some nice connection to symmetry protected top of the order physics that may be worth further exploring. Okay, so there are no questions. Let me go into the first part of my talk. I'm actually not sure what about, what do you mean by local systems? Well, if you are talking about state, then there is no Hamiltonian. Oh, I see. Sure. I would just give a very basic, the simple example of SPT. Okay, so first we aim to find some separation between Hamiltonian and gate-based routing. So first we want to understand when can gate-based routing be very expensive, right? And this is proven in this previous work, which gives this lower bound for the time of gate-based routing. So let me unpack it. So suppose my qubits or fermions live on the vertices lambda of a simple graph, where simple just means that two vertices are connected by at most one edge, and there's no edge like connecting a vertex to itself. And the theorem says, and the gate-based routing is assuming that every gate you use is just on an edge that connecting the two vertices. The edge means like you can only have Hamiltonian terms acting on the edge, or like gates acting on the edge. You're comparing like these two routing protocols. You can allow for like arbitrary large local interactions on a single qubit, arbitrary fast rotations. So there's no need to use that link. Yeah, so this theorem says the following. Suppose I choose any bipartition x, x bar of the total vertices lambda, where x is the smaller one, then this time is lower bounded by the ratio of the volume of x, like how many vertices are there in x, over the volume of the vertex boundary of x. The delta x, the vertex boundary delta x is the vertices in x bar that is connected to x by edges.
So what is T gate here? Is it to prepare a particular state, or is it for creating any kind of correlation?
Yeah, it's like I want to engineer any permutation unitary on all the qubits. So for this, it's basically this. Particular bipartition basically corresponds to I want to say swap all the x qubits to the x bars. So this theorem basically says that this permutation is already hard by this time scale. And so this is basically saying that for gate-based routing you have this bottleneck effect, and it is intuitive because like kind of for every layer of the circuit, if you can at most swap delta x qubits of x away because they have to all go through the delta x vertex boundaries. So for like finding a separation, we probably want to look at something have very severe bottleneck effect, and the simple case is the star graph where I just have like one single qubit coupled to all the other leaf qubits and the leaves do not couple to each other. And I separate the two n leaves to the left and right leaves each containing n qubits. So this is mostly like a theoretical interest, but it also appears in physics settings, for example, nitrogen lattice center plus surrounding spins in solid states. So when you apply the above theorem, it tells you that if you choose x to be just the l qubits, it tells you that you need n time to, say, permute the left qubits with the right n qubits. So this is like sort of n time for. Delta x is c, because delta x is defined as something x bar. And intuitively, it's like every time you can only swap like one qubit out of L. Yeah, so here is our main result. First main result is that we give a square root of n time Hamiltonian protocol, but with the caveat that we only have it for like one fermion per site instead of one qubit per site. Okay, so how does this work? Well, the idea is using the previous W state protocol. We have described it for qubits, but it's also kind of applies for fermions. Where previously it's like I couple C with all the left qubits by like X plus X minus couplings. Here you just replace them by this A plus A, the fermion creation annihilation operators. So then what this Hamiltonian does is kind of just a single hopping term, which hops the center fermion mode with a momentum fermion mode on the left. Okay, so if you use the Hamiltonian for one square root of time, you can swap the center mode with a momentum mode on the left. And the momentum mode is defined this way. So then the idea is straightforward. You just swap the fermion modes one by one, but not using the original fermions, but using the momentum fermions. Because if you have swapped all the momentum modes, then you have also swapped all the original fermion modes. So here, these dots represent momentum modes, and then what you do is just to like first swap one fermion mode with the center, and swap with the corresponding right momentum mode, and then swap the center mode back, and then repeat this n time. And that will give you like a total time square root of n protocol. Yeah, so this also works if you replace the fermion operators by bosonic operators. But although we have tried for some time, it's still an open question. Is there any square root of n qubit protocol that one can come up with? And this is kind of interesting because like usually in this quantum speed limits problems, there is usually not a difference between fermions versus qubits, because usually you can just kind of replace the commutator with anti-commutators, but this is like kind of like one case which seems surprising that there is some difference between these two. Okay, so then we want to understand whether this protocol is optimal, and if you look at this previous work, then it has this lower bound for star graph routing, which says that the routing needs at least order one time. So there's still some gap between this like previous known bound and the protocol. So why is this order one? Well, it is proven by the so-called small incremental entangling theorem. Doesn't matter if you don't know what it is. Basically, the idea is that suppose I want to route n qubits from left to the right, then that is roughly corresponding to I want to generate n amount of entanglement between left and right. And however, there is actually some very fast dynamics that you can engineer to generate entanglement. And the simple example is like if you start from the GGD state on the left and zero state on the center, then you can kind of use a global C naught that just costs 1/n time to generate a GGC shared by left and center. So it's like you order 1/n time, you can already create one bit of entanglement. So if you want to create a total n bit of entanglement, that is like order one time. So is this bound not tight, or is our protocol not optimal? So here comes our second main result, which is that it's actually this bound is not tight. And up to some technical assumption, we show that actually this square root of n time protocol is roughly optimal here. We show that every routing protocol will need time, which is scales like this, where ipso is some arbitrary small positive constant. So what's the technical assumption? We assume that this Hamiltonian has some simple time dependence in the sense that it is piecewise constant, that is in some time window 0 to t1, it is a time independent h1. In t1 to t1 plus t2, it is a time independent h2, etc. And we assume that the time windows are not too short, that they are of order 1 over square root of n, at least that order. Okay, so you'll see why we need this assumption, and we believe it's a technical artifact. But just know that the previous protocol just works in with this piecewise constant Hamiltonians. So in that sense, the protocol is indeed optimal. Okay, so in the next few slides, I'd like to sketch how we prove this theorem, because we think the idea is new and it may be also may also shed light on like proving lower bounds for other problems. So the problem is like, for the unitary U generated by the Hamiltonian, so here for simplicity, I just assume H is time independent. There's no like strict notion of locality, so how do I treat this? So our idea is that I do the following. I approximate U by a kind of circuit, U tilde, and I just need to show two things. First, the approximation itself is good, means that U is close to U tilde, and this problem is really called Hamiltonian simulation. And second, I want to show U tilde is far from the target UP. So what do I mean by close and far? And it turns out that it's crucial to use this metric or distance, which is called the Frobenius distance, to say this close versus far statements. So for any operator A, you can define its Frobenius norm squared to be like trace A dagger A normalized so that the Frobenius norm of every Pauli string is one. And to formalize the above two things or two goals is that if we can prove that U and U tilde is close in Frobenius distance and U tilde is, and UP is far, then by triangle inequality, you can prove that U and UP is also far in Frobenius distance. So here, this 8, 4, et cetera, are just some convenient numbers we choose. And know that if you prove this, then this actually proves something stronger than saying that U and UP are not the same. Because, you know, this Frobenius distance is larger than smaller 1, which means that actually if you take any, if you pick a random state in your total Hilbert space, then these two unitaries actually already act differently on that state. Okay, so what's the U tilde anyway? Here, this U tilde looks like this on the left, on this way, which is like, it's the high order Chotor Suzuki expansion, which means that I view this total Hamiltonian H to be the HL plus HR, where HL couples L to C and HR couples R to C. And for example, in the second order Chotor, you basically want to first separate this total time T into M number of time steps. And for each time step, you can separate the evolution onto like separate evolutions on the left and separate evolution on the right. That is represented by these gates, which are actually like many body gates acting on N plus one qubits. So we choose the parameter such that K is some large constant independent of N, so that every time step it involves a finite number of gates. And on the other hand, we choose M to scale as N, where this coefficient is sufficiently small so that I have totally smaller than n over 6 gates here. So that is the setup. So in the next two slides, I basically want to show that first, this approximation is good, and second, U2 itself is far from UP. Okay, so first, why is the approximation good? If T is much smaller than square root of n, well, here we just perform some standard Chotor error analysis. Let me briefly go through the details. So for Chotor error, you first notice that because you have roughly n time steps, then the total error is just n times the individual errors of each time step, where each time step is smaller than 1 over root 10. then for each time step, you have this commutator error formula. And for when talking about Frobenius distance, you are bounding the Frobenius orthonorm of this k plus 1 commutators of the Hamiltonians. And it turns out that the Frobenius norm plays a role here such that this k plus 1 commutator, its Frobenius norm scales as square root of n to the k plus 1. If you use infinite norm instead, it actually becomes n plus n to the k plus 1, and that will completely makes our bound trivial.
Last question. So here, do you assume time-independent
time domain? Yeah, here, let's just assume time-independent for now. Yeah, it works for like this piecewise constant time-dependent Hamiltonians, and the reason is that as long as your time window is not that long, you can still like separate each time window into several time steps, and each time step is still some time-independent Hamiltonian. Because for trial theory, you just want to know whether it is time-independent in these like small time steps. So that's why it naturally generalizes. Yeah, so actually, we need large k, so that actually is this like t squared root of n to the some large power dominates over this n in front. So that as long as t is smaller than 1 over square root of n, you have this thing is much smaller than 1. But nevertheless, you can gain intuition about, say, why you have commutator error or why you have this square root of n scaling, say in the k to 1 case. So let me just pause for maybe 30 seconds if you want to make sense of this calculation yourself. Okay, so this is like we achieve our first goal, showing that this approximation is good. On the other hand, y is u to the far from up. Well, recall that we say u to the is smaller than n over 6 gates, and that makes u to the certainly not up, because for up you will need like n gates, right? Because you have to swap all the n qubits. However, here we are aiming at something stronger. We want to show that these two interfaces are far even in this Frobenius distance, or even if I pick a typical state, these two interfaces act differently. So here is in a nutshell how we do this. First, we look at a particular initial state, which is like a Z string state on L and C times the identity on the right. And then U2 and UP acts differently on this state because UP just swaps the identity to the left. So it creates maximum entanglement on the left. On the other hand, for U tilde, it can only create at most n over 3 amount of entanglements. And then you want to convert it to say, like for a typical state, these two also does not agree. And on the one hand, this rho z is already kind of sampling a typical state on the right. On the other hand, the argument does not depend on what z is. So by varying z, you can also say it's also kind of sampling a typical state on the left. Question? Oh, just a Z string state, say all zero is like all zero on the L and zero on the C. So just putting everything together, as I said, we have shown like these two things, and you can combine them by triangle inequality to get the desired bound. It's just that as long as T is smaller, much smaller than square root of N, U is far from UP. So just as explained, this naturally generalizes to piecewise constant Hamiltonians as long as the time window is not that short, but it leaves the question open, what about the general time-dependent case? And that is actually related to whether one can actually develop some shorter formulas for general time-dependent Hamiltonian evolution. And finally, our squared open bound actually also generalizes if you add more connections, couplings, that is, you can even allow like order one, all to all couplings on the left and on the right, where each coupling is order one. And so in that sense, our bound really is still capturing this bottleneck effect for Hamiltonian routing. It's just that there's some quadratic difference between Hamiltonian versus gate-based. Okay, so if there are no questions, let me go into the second part of my talk, which is like a focus on this particular permutation entry, which is the shift entry in 1D, which is like you permute the spin 1 to 2, 2 to 3, etc. And if you're on a ring, you permute the final qubit n to 1. And this shift is interesting in the sense that it is a non-trivial quantum cellular automata, or QCA. It is a QCA because it maps local operators to local operators. And it is a non-trivial QCA, means that any finite depth brick wall quantum circuit cannot achieve this shift. And it is well known in terms of the index theory of 1D QCA. Actually, you need actually a linear depth to implement that, which basically says that you just want to kind of swap the gate, swap the qubits one by one, and that's the best you can do. So this index theory is actually has very important applications. For example, classifying phases of 4K systems or serve as disentanglers, which is helpful for understanding topological order. So it is interesting to go beyond this strict locality case, say that instead of like generating shift using some quantum circuit, what about generating it using Hamiltonian evolution? And even what if the Hamiltonian is actually some parallel interaction instead of just considering the nearest neighbor case? Here, the parallel interaction is defined as like every pair of qubits can interact with a strength that decays as the power law with exponent alpha in terms of its distance. So actually, we are not the first to think about this problem. And there's already this previous work, a beautiful math physics paper that kind of generalizes the index theory of 1D QCA to the so-called approximate locality preserving entries. Sorry, question?
Are there two algorithms the same?
Oh, sorry. These are not the same. These are like 0, 1, 2, 3.
Yeah.
Thanks. And this paper have generalized to approximate locality preserving entries that is kind of generated by such parallel interaction Hamiltonians. And for example, their results imply that for sufficiently large alpha, the shift cannot still be generated in finite time. However, there are some caveats of their results, of their theory. So first, they work directly in this infinite lattice limit. And actually, for this shift problem, you naively think that actually the boundary condition is kind of important. Because for infinite lattice, you shift 1, 2, 2, 3, etc., then you might think there's some like very far away right qubit that is mapped to the left, and that may be the hardness of the shift. But for a ring, it's like it's just a global rotation, and it's not that clear. On the other hand, it's not unclear what's the L scaling of the time required to realize shift. And finally, I will call this that they rely on Lieber-Opsen-Lightcone. So I will elaborate on what Lieber-Opsen-Lightcone is and why this is a caveat in the next slide. Okay, so let's say if you start from, if you use Hamiltonian evolution and you ask, well, I Heisenberg evolve a local operator A at set zero, and I ask what's the commutator with a faraway operator BR at set R, what's the norm of the commutator? Then like half a century ago, Lieber and Robson proved that at least for this like geometric local Hamiltonian, this commutator is actually exponentially small as long as t is smaller than, say, r over some velocity v. So this basically says that you have this linear light cone structure where information can only propagate inside this light cone. And in recent years, people have developed a fairly complete generalization to parallel interactions for alpha larger than d. And interestingly, there are kind of several regimes. If alpha is sufficiently large, like larger than 2d plus 1, then you are still in this linear light cone regime, just as the infinity, alpha equal to infinity limit. If alpha is smaller, then you can asymptotically propagate information faster, like an algebraic light cone, or like maybe r can be like t squared. And there is even a regime between d and 2d where you can even have logarithmic or exponential light cone that propagates information exponentially fast. And like for each of these three regimes, there are both bounds and matching protocols. That's kind of saturates the scaling. That's a good question. I think in general it's still open. And I think like the reason is like d is kind of the critical point. Like if alpha is smaller than d, then it's like it's more like orthogonal interaction. And for orthogonal interaction, there is not that this light cone structure anymore, because it's like every qubit is already involved in a large Hamiltonian term. Yeah, and for alpha larger than d, if you can prove this light cone structure, then this actually, so for like quantum information perspective, this constrains the following quantum information processing task. So it constrains the signal task, which is like, suppose I can start from any state, then what's the time it takes for me to transmit a signal from 0 to r? It also constrains how fast I can generate a correlation between two sides of distance r. So this is good, but it does not answer for like what about other tasks? And for example, if you mathematically just change the norm from infinite norm to Frobenius norm, then actually the story becomes already very different. And for example, this is at least proven in 1D that there is no exponential light cone anymore. And as long as alpha is larger than 2 in 1D, you are already in this linear light cone regime. Note that this Frobenius norm can only be slower than the light cone, the Frobenius light cone can only be slower than infinite light cone because Frobenius norm is bounded, upper bounded by Lifshitz norm. But here, it's like people have proven that it's actually asymptotically slower. So for physics, this means that, for example, for like infinite temperature quantum scrambling, it is actually much slower. But for here, like the routing task, it already says that if you want to route a single qubit from 0 to r, that's also much slower, because for this, you have to grow the Frobenius light cone from 0 to r. So then, also from this perspective, the shift problem becomes, from the light cone perspective, the shift problem also becomes interesting. Because on the one hand, for the shift, actually, naively, you won't think the light cone structure will play a role, right? Because each qubit is just moved one side. And however, like in the previous slides, there's this previous work showing that it is actually constrained by the Lib-Robson light cone. However, there is also the intuition that it may actually constrained by the even slower Frobenius light cone instead. Because shift is like moving n qubits one side, and in some sense that is kind of as hard as moving one qubit n sides. So we basically want to understand whether this is actually true. Okay, so here is our main result for this work. We basically prove that if t is smaller than like these expressions for different alpha regimes, then you cannot realize shift. So you don't need to go through all of the expressions. Let me just highlight several things. So first, why do we have these many alpha regimes? Partly because for large alpha regimes, we want to use the Lib-Robson light cone to constrain the time for shift, Well, for smaller alpha, we want to use Fermi cyclone. And indeed, our result shows that the shift is constrained by Fermi cyclone, because if you look at the smallest alpha regime, on the one hand, it is already in the exponential light cone regime for Lib-Robson bound, but on the other hand, we still show that you still need like a power law of the linear size to realize shift. Finally, note that our bound is still, although it's still a bit looser than the time to propagate the Fermi cyclone across the whole chain, and we think that is kind of a technical artifact, and we conjecture that actually the shift should be constrained by the Fermi cyclone directly. Means that, for example, if alpha, as long as alpha is larger than 2, you still need linear time to generate shift. Okay, so let me just briefly sketch how we prove this in one slide. Is there a question? Sorry. Because the idea is very similar as the star graph case, we just construct one approximation circuit U tilde of U that on the one hand the approximation is good, on the other hand U tilde is far from U shift. And what is U tilde in this case? It looks like this. So this is the 1D ring, and U tilde is like composed of 4 gates. The first layer is like 2 gates, UL and UR, acting on the left and right half rings. And the second layer is U0 and UR acting on the upper and lower half of the ring. And you can convince yourself that this gate does not realize shift. So that's kind of the second part. And what about, like, why is this approximation good? Well, let me just slightly go into the idea. The idea is that we use the kind of light cone improved version of Troughton expansion, and sometimes it's also referred to as HHKL algorithm because of this work. Basically, it's like for naive Troughton, suppose your H is like HA plus H cut plus HB, then you just like first evolve using HA and HB, and then you evolve using H cut. But by going to the interaction picture, you can show that you can improve this approximation by using unitary V that is generated by a time evolved H cut instead. And because the time evolution has light cone, for example, if we're talking about Frobenius distance, it is constrained by the Frobenius light cone. And you can just cut this the range of this evolved H cut at some far enough point. And there are some like other technicalities. For example, for parallel impressions, there's not only one H cut, there's also others, and you need to throw away faraway couplings. It turns out that this term is actually subdominant compared to the first one. And also that there's an actual T factor in front, because here, because V is like H cuts generated by H cut in time T. And it's actually this T factor, which we think is a technical artifact that makes, on the one hand, our bound is looser than just Frobenius light cone time. On the other hand, for large enough alpha, is still using the Lib-Robson light cone that gives us better bounds. Okay, so this is maybe like the only one slide in my talk that is kind of a consummator flavor, which is like there is some interesting connection to SPT. So for SPT, there is this well-known result that a non-trivial SPT state requires linear depth symmetric circuit to generate it. Here, let me just show this fact using a very simple example, which is the 1D cluster shape psi, which is defined by stabilizers, that is like Z1, X2, Z3, etc. And this state has this C2 cross C2 symmetry generated by the product of even odd Pauli axis. And this 1D cluster state is a non-trivial SPT in the sense that it has this non-trivial strong order, string order parameter, which is like X in the middle, and Z is on the endpoints. So why is this hard to prepare? Well, suppose it is prepared starting from the symmetric plus product states using a symmetric circuit. And since the symmetric circuit does not evolve the symmetry operators in the bulk, it can only grow the endpoints. So this hardness basically comes from the fact that the string all the parameter can only develop after the two endpoints meet, the light cones of the meet. So it turns out that to understand the hardness of realizing shift, you can use a similar argument. So here, because you're not talking about preparing a state, but preparing a unit tree, you have to kind of promote the space that you are talking about. You have to promote the operator Hilbert space that is like each side is spanned by like four states, like identity state, x, y, z states. It's like four-dimensional Hilbert space, and you tensor product of them to get a full operator Hilbert space. Then for the Euro Heisenberg evolution, that becomes some super unitary U acting on the vectors in the operator space. And you can also define like super density matrices, which is also like operators, super operators acting on the operator states. For example, this curly J is the super identity on the site. So then here's the hardness of realizing shift. Suppose you start from this string super density matrix as the kind of initial state, which is like for the left ring, you have like all super identities. On the right, you have all identity states. Then you'll see that actually you can still only grow the endpoints or the boundary between these two regimes. Because on the one hand, the evolution is super unitary, so it cannot grow, it cannot evolve the super identity regime. On the other hand, because like the Euro unitary U communes with identity, it also does not evolve all identity regimes. So this is like kind of some built-in symmetry in some very loose sense. So it can only evolve endpoints, and for shift, you kind of want to create an extra identity here, super identity here, and that is not possible unless your endpoints have grown to the whole system size and melt the two kind of frozen regions. So how many times do I? Sure, so maybe like I can just kind of, so this slide is just, I want to show you that actually we think our proof method for Hamiltonian lower bound on the one hand is indeed outperforms like previous lower bounds, but we still think there's some ways to improve it. And maybe the most important one I think is like, if you consider the generalized sense of quantum routing, if you want to say ancillary assisted routing, which is like you view like some of your qubits in your system as ancillaries, like labeled by the green parts, and you just want to implement a unitary U that performs permutation on the other qubits, on the other data qubits. And you just let the ancillaries start from zero and you don't care about what they end up with in the end, just that they decouple with the data qubits. For this case, it turns out that our kind of Frobenius strategy for proving lower bounds actually fail. And in some cases, it actually fails due to physical reasons. For example, just for 1D shift, it becomes trivial if you view like the odd points as ancillaries, because you can just use a finite depth circuit to shift the even size to the right and even size to the left and odd size to the right. This is a good exercise for you if you haven't seen this statement before. But in other cases, for example, for the star graph, suppose I view like half of the left and half of the right qubits as ancillaries, then it's like we cannot prove there's still some skirt of n lower bound for permuting the other half of the qubits. But it would be very surprising if like indeed, actually you can permute the half of the qubits very much faster than permuting all the qubits. So it's unclear like what's the true story here. Okay, so finally, let me conclude. So hopefully I have shown you that it's important to understand the quantum speed limits for various tasks. For quantum routing, we have developed like examples of separation, and we have developed a method of proving meaningful Hamilton lower bounds. So some outlook. First, we have seen that like maybe there's like even new strategy for lower bounds, or does our lower bound technique apply to other tasks? And we also see that there is some intimate connection between routing lower bounds and quarter errors for general time-dependent Hamiltonians. Finally, as have been asked, like what happens for alpha smaller than d? It's kind of a very widely open problem. For example, it's interesting to see that, for example, for all-to-all gate protocols, you can already shift the qubits in order one time using this right like peculiar structure. So is this structure like generalizable? I don't know. So more broadly, you want to achieve a protocol faster, but also you want it to be like robust against like imperfections. Also, what if you add measurements plus adaptive feedback that probably can also even make your protocol even faster. So with that, I'd like to thank you for your attention. I'm happy to take questions either just after the talk or like I'm very happy to discuss during my stay in these 2 weeks. So thank you. Yeah, that's a good question. I actually haven't think about like the noisy robustness problems that much. Naively, I think what I can say is like Hamiltonian is just like you in reality you just realize gates using Hamiltonians. So maybe the in reality, you want to realize, say, two qubit gates, you still like turn on some Hamiltonian interaction between these two qubits. So maybe in that sense, they accumulate error in a similar way. On the other hand, if your noise in your experiments is like decoherence noise, it's just like a qubit sits there for some time, and even if you don't act any Hamiltonian gates on it, it is decohered, then certainly probably you want your protocol to be faster, so that this decoherence error is much less if your like total evolution time is shorter. But for like the error accumulated for like this gate errors or Hamiltonian errors, I'm not. Yeah, so, but there is some hope that maybe it's like for, like this is the gate routing, this the gates protocol, this Hamilton protocol, maybe it's like they have the same total error at last, because like the Hamiltonian, even if it is faster, the noise also propagates faster. But even if the noise, the total error is close, then this Hamiltonian is still faster. So in that sense, like the Hamiltonian one is still advantageous. I'm not sure if there are reasons to think that maybe the Hamiltonian, the total error of the Hamiltonian evolution is like even worse than the gate. But that would be also very interesting.
Well, we can just try it on the W state, right? We can design a very simple error model for Hamiltonian simulation and also the gate simulation.
Sure. So what kind of more specific?
Like, I often think the depths of the circuit is discrete. Characterize the circuit, how long you need to do this But Hamiltonian time is continuous. And you compare those two, I often find it a little bit uncomfortable.
I see. So naively, you can just say, like, so I just look at the kind of interior time.
Times. Because date is like short, unitary. Okay, I got it.
Oh, cool.
I guess you can multiply Hamiltonian by 2 and say that time used by half.
Why?
Because if I increase the amplitude of Hamiltonian by everything by 2, then There will be n times happening on this particular qubit. Isn't that problematic in a sense that if I think about Hamiltonian as like these popping things, then like local energy I can create by a single operator could be divergent.
Sure. Yeah. I see. So, yeah, indeed, that will diverge for this W protocol.
Yeah, then that's also, I think, related to the error question, because that's like the power to amplify the error. So that part, I probably want to keep it finite, probably.
Yeah, I agree with you. But I just want to comment that maybe in experiments, it is not so hard to implement this kind of diverging local interaction because it's kind of just like shining the lasers on all of the pairs. Question?
So I kind of, I don't know if it's practical, but have you considered like how this fits into a larger system to actually perform universal quantum computation? Because obviously in a gate-based model, you can assume that you can have a certain set of gates and then you can prove certain theorems because of that. So you've shown that given like a certain form of a Hamiltonian here, you can do this. Is the model you've used enough to perform like universal? If not, what do you need to add? And then does the combination of that have any like, you know, change on the actual overall complexity? So like if you're using something like this as your only way to form entanglement, for example, is it better for some cases, but like, does it not scale well?
Yeah, that's a very good question. So I have also kind of think along these lines a bit, and it seems like there's not that much discussion in the literature. But I think it's indeed like, for example, if you want to like really build a quantum computer like in this optical cavity case, then probably you just want to implement this all-to-all Hamiltonians. And so on the one hand, you can say, okay, so what's the minimal amount of Hamiltonians I desire to in order for a universal computation. And for that, I think, if you assume all-to-all interaction where the couplings can be different, then certainly you can like just do 2-qubit gates and that's universal. So there may be like one like more precise question is like maybe you can just do like this global controls. It's like I can only have uniform couplings between the atoms, then can I do universal computation? I think that's an interesting question, although I don't know the answer.
When you're assuming all to all, you're assuming all to all, not everything up to all, right? Like not just like 1 to 1, 1 to 2, 2 to 3. Like when you assume you can do all to all, it's one operation that has all to all involved, not all set of operations that can have every independent combination. For that, I'm meaning when you're saying all to all, you're not allowed to have sort of a subsystem which you're doing nothing on. Is that correct?
Oh, I see. Yeah, sure. Probably like if you want to do like subsets operations, then maybe you want to separate the atoms and then do out all things and then combine them. That's my like naive guess from like a theorist perspective.
I guess like a slight variation on this error question. So, so this Hamiltonian strategy, you want to evolve for some time, and you have some this bound for how much time, how the time scales with n and so on. But how sensitive is it to exactly the stop time? Do I have to resolve that time to arbitrary high precision for the routing problem to solve? And yeah. I would imagine that with this extensive Hamiltonian, there might be an issue that the resolution, you have to resolve that stop time to very high precision. Is that correct?
Yeah, I think that would be correct. For example, for this like W state protocol, if you just vary your time slightly by 1√n, then you just hop your like extension back to your center. And indeed, yeah, so in that sense, maybe it's like there's indeed some like more dangerous things you should be careful about like Hamiltonian protocols. Because like this stopping time is also like one type of error that can appear naturally. Yeah, I think, yeah, that's fair, I think, yeah.
I was curious, do you know to what extent these problems have been addressed for continuous degrees of freedom bosons and all?
Uh-huh, so I've been working on, say, like, proving Lyapunov bounds, even for, like, geometric local bosonic systems on finite dimensions. And even for that, it's like, it's only, like, people only have recent results on that. And if you have like even more connectivity for bosonic modes, then at least for like Hamiltonian lower bounds, it's like very unclear. For protocols, so what's interesting about bosons is that like even if you start from like a low density bosonic state, then in your dynamics you can like intentionally group your boson state to one side. Then you have this like boson enhancement factor like √n or even like √n square. And that thing can actually indeed enhance your speed. For example, it has been shown that if you are in like d-dimensional geometric local bosonic systems, then you can propagate the light cone, say with r is like t to the d. And what you do is just to crank up bosons. Yeah, and I think it'll be also interesting to think about maybe like boson sampling problems, like because like sometimes this kind of quantum advantage is also like you want this dynamics to be too non-local to be intractable by classical computers. So maybe there's also some connection on that line, which will be super interesting. Mm-hmm. So here I'm mostly focused on just like a random two qubit couplings, but for specific protocols you can have like much simpler couplings. If you just have like XX like an isolated coupling, then probably at least from like spin squeezing ideas, I think you can use time-dependent Hamiltonian, which is like sometimes you apply this DZ isolated coupling, and sometimes you have like just single qubit rotations. If you can rotate single qubits very fast, then you can kind of engineer all of the other couplings, and that is sufficient for generating, say, the maximally spin squeeze state in very short time. And maybe in general, that's also the procedure that you want to do if you just only have natural like DZ couplings.
Yeah, because maybe I didn't listen carefully, but to me that the protocols, they are all based on this, either the swap operator or like W state, or it seems like all on the computational basis level. And I was just wondering if there could be a different story if you consider like this non-commuting Hamiltonian.
Sorry, what do you mean by non-commuting Hamiltonian?
I mean, if you don't stay on the level of computational basis.
Oh, I see. Yeah, so I have this previous work talking about like how local operators can grow in like all-to-all interactions. And in that case, indeed, we think about just the operators instead of the a state basis. And indeed, you can think about it this way. It's like you just take commutators on the operators and then talk about like how long this operator can grow large. But it's very difficult, I would think, to relate this story to design a protocol for preparing a given state, because state is like very different from like growing an operator. So maybe to phrase it in another way, it would be interesting to ask like what's the kind of natural quantum information processing task that you can ask about, like if I can grow operator in this way, then what task I can achieve. And then you maybe want to consider like in the operator story.
Yeah, and also I was wondering, do you think your result can somehow imply some result in the separation between discrete time random quantum walk and the continuous time quantum walk?
Yeah, that's a very interesting question. So I think for quantum walk, I guess, I view quantum walk as kind of a non-interacting limit of like mind-body dynamics, right? Because quantum walk is like just free fermions hopping. So here I'm mostly interested in like what if you have like general interacting Hamiltonians, then it's like quantum walk is certainly like a subclass of these systems. But I guess you can also formulate our story to like, for example, the separation between classical versus quantum walk. But I'm not that familiar with it. So.
Okay, so if there are